Welcome to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. And that was sound from outside the Michigan Supreme Court last week, while inside justices heard arguments that will impact if you decide who draws congressional and legislative districts every decade. Capital correspondent Shayna Roth was in the courtroom, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So what is this case all about, Shayna?
Basically, it is about completely overhauling how Michigan draws its political district lines. And those are those crazy lines that you see on super nerdy maps that say which district you live in and who your representative, your senator is in every time you vote. And what this proposal would do is it would change the current process, and the current process has the state legislature every 10 years basically redraw those lines and have it go through the process as it would any other bill. And the concern there is that, well, whichever party happens to be in power every 10 years is the one that really has all of the control over how those lines are drawn, and they can manipulate those lines in some cases to, you know, either benefit them or to have a negative impact towards the other party. Obviously, if you ask the people who are drawing the lines, they will say, no, we're being very fair and impartial. And what this proposal seeks to do is to take the politics and the politicians out of that process. They want to form an independent redistricting commission made up of the same amount of Republicans, Democrats, and independents, and then have that group essentially working with the people redraw those lines.
And what are both sides saying in this case?
Well, let's start with the people who are against the proposal, because they're the ones that have sort of brought this case there, because the Court of Appeals said that the ballot proposal was okay. And the reason we're in the Michigan Supreme Court is because the opposing group decided to appeal it. And what they're basically saying is, look, this proposal is just goes too far. It would completely change the structure of government. It would shift around the powers of the state government, and it would just be too big of an overhaul. And that a ballot proposal is not the way to go about doing it. The state solicitor general, which is in the attorney general's office, he argued in front of the court, and he said, you know, this process can be changed, but given all of the nuances of this proposal, this would be better suited for something called a constitutional convention, which is a whole other ball of wax and is a very complicated thing to go about doing. What the other side says, Voters Not Politicians, which is the grassroots group behind this proposal, what they have to say is, look, we have done all of the legwork. We followed the proposal. We got it all approved by the Board of State Canvassers. We have, you know, fought this battle in the Court of Appeals. They said the proposal was fine. And what they're arguing is that the people should be allowed to vote on this procedure. They say that their proposal meets all of their requirements, is in good shape, and they just want to, as we heard, let the people vote.
Do we have any idea what Republicans and Democrats are hoping for out of this decision?
You know, it's interesting because the proposal itself and the group behind it says that, you know, this is completely nonpartisan, that they are trying to take away those politics from this process. But we have seen the opposition mainly come from Republicans, and they are the ones who, in theory, stand to gain the most, because it seems, you know, unless there's a huge blue wave, that they could maintain their power in the state government and then get a chance to redraw those district lines again. Whereas Democrats, particularly over the last few years, they have tried on their own to get a change in there for how these lines are drawn, to no avail, because they are not in the majority in the legislature. So Democrats have really kind of said that, you know, we are in favor of this and we would like to see how these lines are drawn be changed.
Any idea of when the court will make its decision?
We don't know. You know, these types of courts are notorious for deciding things in their own time. However, the Secretary of State did come forward, or a representative actually from the Secretary of State did come forward and say, look, we have to get our ballot certified by mid-September, by early September. Can you please, you know, make a decision by early August, preferably by the primary? So everybody is hoping, particularly the Secretary of State, to get a decision by early August. I would imagine, given that the Supreme Court is very cognizant of what is at stake here, but also that there is a lot that needs to happen afterwards, that they will probably follow that and we'll have a decision by early August.
That was Capitol correspondent Shana Roth talking to us about the Michigan Supreme Court case about drawing congressional and legislative districts. Before we let you go, we understand you're headed up to Washington, D.C.
Yes, I will be in D.C. next week. Interim MSU President John Engler will be testifying in front of a U.S. Senate subcommittee. So I will be packing my bags and we'll be headed out there to see what happens.
And it's the same congressional hearing that I believe former President Luana K. Simon testified before.
Yes, and we're not 100% sure what exactly they will be talking about. But given John Engler's track record of being very candid, I think it will be in for some interesting surprises.
We'll look forward to your reports from there. That's Capitol correspondent Shana Roth. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
You can hear Shana every weekday on Morning Edition and afternoons and All Things Considered here on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Thanks for listening to Current State here on WKAR. If you ask a young child what summer slide means, you're likely to hear something about their favorite playground or water park. But ask a teacher, and you'll get entirely a different answer. For them, summer slide means losing valuable reading skills learned in the school year before. Each week, education reporter Kevin Lavery reports on what's being done to turn around Michigan schools' low rankings when it comes to reading. Today, the summer slide.
Okemos, Michigan, 10 a.m. Clear skies, 80 degrees. The pad sits ready. Major Tom is putting his helmet on. Metaphorically speaking.
Ground control to Major Tom.
One shot off. Then there were three. Three little rockets with nothing to do. One shot off.
At his feet, a half a dozen tiny ground control crew members are helping Tom Schultz with the launch.
I don't want to fly to the sun, I'll melt!
They're sitting on the floor and soaring into space. Just the way reading should be. Schultz is the youth librarian with the Capital Area District Libraries in Okemos. Today he's reading Earth, Space, Moon Base by Ben Joel Price. These storytime sessions get the kids reading, talking, playing, singing, and writing. All these activities add up to the concept called literacy. Summer is a busy time for the Okemos Branch Library. It's when head librarian Betsy Hull makes a strong pitch to her patrons with young children.
Sit down with them and enjoy the book that you're reading right there, right then. It can be a picture book. It can be anything that they want to read through together. That's where it all starts.
Building good reading skills can be a challenge when school is out. That's especially true for economically disadvantaged kids who have few learning resources. The Boys and Girls Club of Lansing offers summer recreation for more than 250 children every day. But there's also time set aside for tutoring. Lois Demps is a retiree and full-time volunteer in the RSVP Foster Grandparent Program.
What I'm finding is that a lot of the kids are very, very willing to learn. And they especially like it when there's a little competition there. So it's turning out great and I'm enjoying it. I think they're benefiting.
Today, Demps is having some quality one-on-one time with 7-year-old Isaiah. He's reading about a red hen.
Red. Hence is a...
The program director here, Christina Medina, has an acute interest in Isaiah's reading ability. He's her son.
Yes. He likes it. He doesn't really always enjoy it because he struggles.
The school wanted to hold Isaiah back in kindergarten, Medina explains, but could not because of his age. Isaiah is going into the second grade. Once he gets to third, he'll be required to meet the state reading proficiency standard or else face retention. Lois Bader knows there's a lot of kids in Michigan like Isaiah, and she's not a fan of the new law.
This is going to be devastating. There's no question about it. Some adjustments are going to have to be made.
Bader is the executive director of the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. She's an emeritus professor at Michigan State University who still teaches literacy coursework to education students. More than 100 of them work with her each semester as reading tutors. Bader is a strong advocate of reading to children from an early age, but she feels the state's one-size-fits-all mandate doesn't tailor to individual student development.
Children grow at different rates, and sometimes extremely bright children are not ready to read until fourth grade, but we don't give them a chance.
The hen are
good.
Back at the Boys and Girls Club, Isaiah Medina makes it through his lesson. His mother, Christina, dabs her tears.
After he read the story, he just came into me, Mom, I read the whole story, and he was like, I did it, I sound out all the words. So just to see the joy on his face, knowing that he actually was able to read it on his own, that just makes a mother just feel just happy, and just I'm thrilled, and it just emotional at the same time, just to see that my baby is able to finally break through.
The book is a small victory. Literacy is a journey, not a destination. But Isaiah is fueling up his own rocket. In Lansing, Kevin Lavery, WKAR News.
Look for Kevin's reports every Tuesday morning at 6:45 and 8:45 during Morning Edition here on 90.5 WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Staying with education, Michigan is the only state in the U.S. that needs intervention for its special education programs in its schools. That's according to the U.S. Department of Education. Ben Thorpe has more.
According to the federal department, Michigan failed to meet the requirements of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. The report indicates that the state's dropout rate for students with disabilities was 29%, well over the federal benchmark for Michigan of just over 8%. Mark Moody is with the Department of Counseling and Special Education at Central Michigan University.
I would say that there's reason for concern, but I think we've taken steps, you know, already to start to address some of these things. I don't think this came to a shock to anyone in the field.
A spokesperson for the Michigan Department of Education declined to comment, saying the department is in the process of reviewing the report. The U.S. Department of Education also declined to comment, saying, quote, "We're letting the contents of the letter and other documents speak for themselves." I'm Ben Thorpe.
Just ahead on Current State, another sanctuary church pops up in the Capital Region. Also, despite decades of trying, Michigan does not protect LGBT people when it comes to jobs and housing.
And so it's the frustration is the fact that on a human level, so many of my colleagues are incredibly nice, they are gracious. You know, then when it comes to politics, though, that we can't put up the vote to make sure that all people are given a fair shot.
We'll talk to a lawmaker trying to change that. And later, meet a dad on a mission to stop opioid addiction. This is Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. This week, Crystal Ray Parish in Lansing announced it will serve as a sanctuary church to protect immigrants on the verge of deportation in response to President Donald Trump's zero-tolerance immigration reforms. WKAR's Laura Michaels reports.
Crystal Ray Parish leaders say they will be housing immigrants in immediate danger of deportation while providing them with legal services needed to petition for a stay. Oscar Castaneda is with Action of Greater Lansing, a community organizing group partnering with Crystal Ray. He says once a person is given sanctuary, his group will get the word out about the character of the person to defunct what he says are myths about immigrants.
Oh, this person is a good person, someone who, according with the most typical American values, is a person who deserves a chance to do what they want to do.
Though it serves a largely Latino congregation, Crystal Ray is actually the second Lansing area church to designate itself as a sanctuary. The holdup for some members was fear of attracting attention, since some are still working on their papers. For WKAR, I'm Laura Michaels.
Thank you. listening to Current State from WKAR. Michigan has a complicated history when it comes to rights for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities. In 1972, East Lansing and Ann Arbor were the first cities in the nation to pass protections for gays and lesbians. In 1974, a lesbian, Kathy Kozinchenko, became the first openly gay elected official in the U.S. when she was elected to the Ann Arbor City Council. But according to the Human Rights Campaign, Michigan still lacks several laws protecting the LGBTQ community, including protections in housing, employment, public accommodations, or education. Lawmakers have tried and failed more than a dozen times to change the state's Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act to include the LGBTQ community. We wanted more insight into this. Joining us now is Democratic State Representative John Hoadley of Kalamazoo. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Last year, you tried to introduce protections for the LGBTQ community into Elliot Larson. How was that received?
I actually tried to do this now for a couple of sessions since I've been here, and I'm picking up the baton that has been passed on for the last 30 years. This is a project that has been in the works for a long time because we know that discrimination against LGBT folks is happening in the state of Michigan, and we need our laws to make sure that when folks experience discrimination, that there's a remedy that's available for them under the law. Every time we introduce it, the response is similar. We hear the public saying, I thought that was already the law, that you couldn't discriminate against someone for being LGBT. We hear folks in labor and the business community say, we absolutely need to adopt these laws because we need to attract the best talent for Michigan. And then we hear nothing from the Republican-controlled legislature. And unfortunately, that's got to change.
How does not having laws that protect people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender affect Michiganders?
Well, it affects all of us. It doesn't matter if you're gay or straight. The truth is, if we don't have protections based on who you are, who you love, then what ends up happening is that really core aspects of your life are subject to the whim of your employer or a realtor or your school. And that's not right. Yeah, I think we all want the freedom to be judged based on the qualities that we bring to the table. You know, can we get the work done? Do we have the right type of ethic and training to be qualified for the positions? And when employers are allowed to then fire someone because they don't like the fact that someone's LGBT, or, you could similarly fire someone for being straight, it's wrong no matter how you're cutting it. And until we have a law that says that, that can continue. And it matters for all of us because when families are deciding where they want to move, when people's children are deciding whether they're going to continue to make Michigan their home after growing up here, if they feel like that they can't be who they are because of who they love, they'll look to other places. And then we're losing out on some of the best talent. We're keeping families apart. And that's the wrong direction for the state of Michigan.
We are speaking with State Representative John Hoadley of Kalamazoo. On the other side, some say they shouldn't have to serve a population that their religion may disagree with, and to serve LGBTQ people infringes on their freedom of religion. What do you say to that?
I think the Supreme Court has been very clear on this, that if you hang your sign out into the public and saying we're a business that serves the public, then you have to serve the entire public. And in fact, with the Masterpiece decision recently, that was yet another one of the core findings of the majority opinion, that we have to make sure that we're doing so in a respectful way, that we have to honor and listen to the sincerely held religious beliefs of folks. But that itself is not an excuse to then exclude someone from the marketplace, to choose to fire them or choose not to hire them just because of who they are may conflict with someone's religious beliefs. And, I think that's really important that as a country, we're finding ways that we can be very respectful. I think we somehow lost that in our debate. But at the same time, we have to make sure that our civil rights laws are strong, that if you choose to serve the public, you serve the entire public.
Could you give me some insight into the kind of conversations you have with lawmakers who may oppose adding protections for gays and lesbians?
A lot of this is about making sure that the LGBT community is represented in decision-making bodies. I'm one of three openly LGBT members of the legislature. And the truth is that You know, if you aren't in those tables, at those tables, if you aren't in those conversations, it's really hard to make change happen, which is why it still matters that we have a diverse set of people representing us. And I mean that in the broadest set of terms. But I'll tell you that privately, a lot of lawmakers on both sides of the aisle get it, that discrimination is bad for business, it's bad for our communities, it's not the right or moral thing to do. And so they're ready to update their laws. And what we're seeing is, you know, partisan politics get in the way, where there are a set of special interests on the Republican side of the aisle that are preventing a bill like making sure that we prohibit discrimination against the LGBT community from reaching a vote on the floor. We need to fix that.
On your website, you talk about having a partner and the world's friendliest beagle. How frustrating is it on a personal level as a gay man to see that these protections have not been put into place and it's been a 30-year struggle?
Personally, it's really frustrating. You know, I bring my partner, Chris, to a lot of the stuff that we do here in the legislature. He's, you know, been fairly warmly received. And, you know, I will say this, he's a guy that doesn't like politics. And so it actually turns out, I think he, a lot of the other sort of spouses end up relating to that pretty well. A lot of our representatives are, I would say, from mixed marriages where, maybe one person's a little bit more political than the other. And so it's the frustration is the fact that on a human level, so many of my colleagues are incredibly nice. They are gracious. Then when it comes to politics, though, that we can't put up the vote to make sure that all people are given a fair shot to succeed, that all people are going to be treated fairly and equally. And, you know, it's just frustrating when politics get in the way of that. And I think it's one of the reasons that people need to come out in terms of their support for non-discrimination protections in support of full equality for LGBT people, even when we think it's a settled matter, because the Supreme Court has said LGBT folks have the same right to marry as everybody else. But it's, you know, so if you're talking to someone and you're a Republican and you're talking to a Republican primary candidate who's running for office, you should be talking about how the American dream, how our freedoms and how our liberties includes people who are LGBT. And if you're talking to Democratic candidates, you should be pushing them on the same sort of issues. If we believe in equal justice under law, which is one of the core Democratic beliefs, then we've got to make sure that advocating for all people, including LGBT folks, is a core part of our advocacy. But it really comes down to everyday Michigan people having just real, authentic conversations with the candidates when you run into them and they're at your door or you're at their coffee hour, or you see them in the grocery store, because that's how we're going to make a difference here.
What do your constituents in Kalamazoo think about that?
In my neck of the woods in Kalamazoo, they are incredibly supportive. In 2009, we passed a non-discrimination ordinance in the city of Kalamazoo that was fully inclusive of sexual orientation and gender identity. And some folks tried to challenge that and put it on the ballot. And what we saw is overwhelming support to keep the non-discrimination ordinance whole when it went, ultimately was up for a vote. Over 12,000 people weighed in, and the vast majority of them said, we want a city that does not discriminate. And so, you know, I know that this is a core part of what my constituents believe. I've knocked doors all across the state, and, you know, the conversations are the same everywhere you go. They might use different words. They might have different examples. But at the end of the day, you know, most Michiganders believe that everybody deserves the same shot at the American dream. And that means that we have to stop discriminating against folks so everybody has the same chance to succeed or fail based on the merits and the work they put in, not the person that they love.
That was State Representative John Hoadley of Kalamazoo talking with us about the lack of statewide protections for Michiganders who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. And thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The city of Lansing is proposing a bike path from Grand Avenue in downtown Lansing to the east side of the Frandor area. WKAR's Katie Cook has details.
The project, which is being called the East Side Connector, would consist of a combination of bike lanes, pathways, and assigned bike route to benefit cyclists and pedestrians. Lansing's Public Service Director Andy Kilpatrick says the idea was part of the non-motorized plan the city put together in 2011.
Right now, the only direct bike facility to downtown is along Kalamazoo Street. So we thought that it would be good to have a second route, and this also will connect the neighborhood to the school, so through several school properties as well.
The city is still seeking approval from the Lansing School District to construct the remainder of the pathway on district property. If approved, it would be done in conjunction with the work planned for the Eastern High School fields and the future location of Eastern High at Pattengill. Jeff Potter is a Williamson resident who leads bike rides with the local club Lansing Bike Party. He says biking between East Lansing and Lansing can be tricky, and this path will likely make it safer and encourage more people to bike.
I think bike use, once they mark this all up, might increase, and if they make improve the safety of the crossings, may go up 5 or 10-fold, along those routes, just from them making it more explicit for bikes.
The path would be constructed in 2019 and possibly into 2020, according to Kilpatrick. Close to $500,000 in federal funds has been approved for construction of the project, which is 80% of the cost. The remainder would be paid for by the city. In Lansing, I'm Katie Cook.
You should never take more than you give in the circle of life.
Did you know royalty is in East Lansing? You have one more week to catch The Lion King at the Wharton Center. Fine arts reporter Jamie Paisley talked with two cast members who've made this production so memorable.
It is nice to get the first word in. And for The Lion King, South African actress Mukulisiwe Goba, she gets to use her original language, Zulu, to announce that the lion is on its way.
Yeah, here comes the lion. Nantsingonyama bagiti baba, here comes the lion. Yeah, it's not easy. I think that's why they always bring South African in the show, so that we can teach other people how to pronounce. It doesn't feel nice when you hear something bad. I'm like, oh, you don't have to say that. But hey, but when we have actually people who knows how to say that, it's good.
While Mukulisiwe Goba has been part of various casts of The Lion King over the past 6 years, her castmate Tony Freeman has been doing it for 18, 11 of which as the puppet Zazu, which took lots of training to perfect.
I thought they were going to bring in somebody from Jim Henson Puppets and teach me how to do the puppets. I walked into my first day of rehearsal on Broadway. They had a row of mirrors set up. And they handed me the puppet and said, make it look like it's alive. Ooh. And I was like, that's my training. Make it look like it's alive. And you just practice for hours in front of a mirror. So every expression on that puppet has to be memorized by our arm, by our hand, so that without even looking at it, we know what the expression is on his face, so that we can look at who we're talking to.
I saw a rather uninspiring thing.
Oh, I just can't wait to be king.
But of course, sometimes with wires, mistakes happen, as Mukulisiwe reminds Tony.
No, you should ask that, Tony, because it happened to you guys with you in your scene with Mufasa.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was on his scar, and our wires got tangled with each other. So when he started falling off the cliff, he started pulling me with him. Mm. We have crew guys there to protect us, of course, and they stopped it. And here we're both just dangling in midair waiting to be rescued. But it's live theater.
While The Lion King will be in residency at the Wharton Center now through July 29th, a special sensory-friendly matinee has been scheduled for Saturday, July 21st. This marks the first main stage Broadway tour to incorporate the sensory-friendly experience at the Wharton Center.
This is a very special performance for us. We only do this once a year or once every 2 years. They used to call it the autism-friendly performance because people all along the spectrum would come and see it. But now, so many people are interested in seeing the show that now they just call it sensory friendly. It's challenging for the actors because it can get very loud. They just get loud in their responses to what they're seeing. So the actors have to stay really focused. The lights don't completely go down.
Yeah, that's another thing. We can see them moving around, but it's okay.
But it means so much to the kids and to their parents. Mm-hmm. That they can bring their children to see a live show, which they normally would feel like, I don't want to annoy everybody around me. So it's a chance to like bring your child to the theater and just feel comfortable and let them enjoy the show. So we love doing it.
Oh yeah, it's so. I wish we can do this like maybe twice a month.
Yeah,
it's really nice.
It's really beautiful.
It's pure. Wow. He lives in you.
He lives in me. Mokolisi Wegoba is Rafiki, and Tony Freeman will be a few characters in Disney's The Lion King at the Wharton Center now through July 29th. Tickets and more information at whartoncenter.com. In East Lansing, Jamie Paisley, WKAR News.
Just ahead, the role IT could play in fighting the opioid epidemic.
There's increasing recognition that this information is needed in order for us to make good decisions about what's happening.
Remember Crystal Pepsi? Our Serving Up Science team reveals some secrets about a casualty of the cola wars.
A short lifespan for a product so heavily invested in.
And learn why Michigan's blueberry crop may be the best in years. You're listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. A father from Okemos says his son would have probably been an accountant or a lawyer had he not died of an opioid overdose in 2011 when he was 25 years old. Now, the dad is on a mission to help stop addiction as soon as possible. WKAR's Laura Michaels reports.
Phil Pavona didn't know his son Eric had entered the ravages of opioid abuse until it was too late. Eric died of an overdose on his parents' wedding anniversary in 2011.
There are two drugs you don't want to play with. Opiates and meth are the two worst. What meth and opiates do to the brain and how it restructures the brain, it's terrible.
Sparrow Hospital says throughout a 5-county area in mid-Michigan, opioid-related deaths are up almost 18% as compared to the same time last year. Part of the problem is the potency of drugs like fentanyl.
These guys aren't chemists. By the time it reaches, you know, someone like my son, it's touched 5 hands. So you have no idea what you're getting.
After Eric's death, Phil started Families Against Narcotics to serve as a support structure to help families beat drug addiction. Phil says if he had found out about his son's addiction earlier, he may have been able to help him beat it.
I'm sure he was the light of the party at, you know, Rick's in East Lansing. You know, none of those kids bothered to pick up a phone and say, hey, Mr. Pavona, you know, Eric's in trouble.
It's a phone call that may save any addicted person's life. For WKAR, I'm Laura Michaels.
The explosion of opioid overdoses and deaths in America and in Michigan has been well documented. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there were more than 2,300 drug overdose deaths in Michigan in 2016, an increase of almost 20% over the previous year. WKAR's Scott Pohl attended a recent conference in Lansing, where experts discussed the role internet technology could play in fighting the spread of opioid use.
At that conference, I talked with Dr. Joyce DeYoung of the Western Michigan University Homer Stryker MD School of Medicine. She serves as the medical examiner for 11 counties. Dr. DeYoung says that in nearly every opioid-related fatality, including illicit cases involving heroin or fentanyl, there was a previous prescription for an opioid.
Now, maybe it hasn't been recently, and maybe that drug wasn't present at the time, but they have a history of prescription abuse, or prescription use. And I think that we already know that there is prescription overuse and that there's some correlation between that. But I also think that there may be some times where we're looking to see if it's possible that their pathway to their heroin or their fentanyl was different from opioid use. And what was it that caused them to go to the street to buy their drugs?
One of the problems that seemed to come up today was that we're chasing the data, and it's taking months or a year or more to compile the data and see where it takes us. What can we do to improve that?
Right now, all of our results actually come to us as PDF files. Now, we have the benefit of having them an interface with our toxicology laboratory. But even a lot of medical examiner offices are significantly underfunded and understaffed because there aren't enough forensic pathologists. So you're waiting months for them to even be able to sign out their cases, right? So we have a staffing problem in forensic pathology and in the medical examiner offices. And I'll knock on wood right now, because right now we're fully staffed and we're not experiencing that, but it is a nationwide problem, and Michigan is not immune from that. So if you go to some of the other offices just in Michigan, it will take months to get a report out because they don't have enough people. So it's just even just getting that report. But now that report comes out, and it is essentially a PDF file or, you know, a signed document that somebody... If somebody's interested in that data, there's no mechanism currently for that information to be disseminated, other than by death certificates. But death certificate data isn't strong, and there's a lot of variability in how people do their death certificates.
You said here today that in some cases information is transmitted by fax machine still and through the U.S. mail, and that bogs the system down.
Well, it can. We ask for records. We need records when somebody, we like to review their medical history when somebody died, and it's even a potential drug overdose, but even if it, whatever the scenario is, when we put a call out for records, that's how they're transmitted to us. We have one hospital that allows us access to Epic. We have somebody. Epic is their software system where they keep all of their medical records. It's their, I don't know the fancy term for it. But we can log in and see it right, real time. Okay. But everybody else, it's just, you know, you want that information and they say, okay, we'll get that to you. Now, our fax machine is electronic, okay, but, you know, so it's not like the old time machine. But so it comes to us electronically. I don't know what they have on their end, but we have all these hospitals in all of our counties. And yet, in order for us to get information about that patient, they require to be sent through the post, through the mail, or which, of course, delays things.
One last question. If it's important to have this data in days or weeks rather than months or years, what's your level of optimism, if any, that we'll get there sometime soon?
I think there's a push for it. I think that there's increasing recognition that this information is needed in order for us to make good decisions about what's happening. I'm confident that we don't know what's happening in much of Michigan because of different practice habits, and that information just isn't being reported adequately. So I think because there's significant attention being paid to it, it may happen, but it requires money. It requires funding for this to happen. So that would be probably the biggest issue.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. It's blueberry season in Michigan. Jennifer Weingart reports this year's crop is shaping up to be a good one in volume and in flavor.
Michigan accounts for about one-fifth of the American blueberry market. Nearly 20,000 acres of plants is expected to produce about 90 million pounds of blueberries this year. There were some problems early in the season with heavy rainfall keeping some growers from getting fungicides sprayed, and also with sun scald when the weather got really hot. Mark Longstrow is a small fruit educator with the Michigan State University Extension Service. He says now they have other problems.
Now we've got good volumes and good quality, good flavor fruit, and the big problem is just getting it off the bush as fast as it's ripening.
Longstroth says some growers are having difficulties getting enough pickers. Blueberries for the fresh market are usually picked by hand because they're a pretty delicate fruit. He says there may also be some issues with timing irrigation with picking, as little to no rain across the state means growers will have to water their bushes, and they can't do that with workers in the field. I'm Jennifer Weingart.
Food is the language everyone speaks, but do we truly understand it?
Between the conversations over organic food and GMOs, different diets taking the world by storm, and how what we eat actually impacts our environment,
there's no shortage of things to learn about. Hi, I'm Karel Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum, and this is Serving Up Science. The year was 1992. Bill Clinton became the 42nd president, and Donald Trump appeared in Home Alone 2. Wayne's World debuted at the movies, and I was 12 years old. How old were you, Karel?
I was born.
Okay, so my memory of the early 90s is probably a little better than yours. I had braces, big hair.
Cheryl, you still have big hair.
But it was cool then.
Hey, it's cool again.
1992 was a good year for music as well, because this little band out of Seattle called Nirvana was changing music as we knew it. But it was a bad year for soda.
And that it was.
I didn't realize it at the time, but we have a story this week about a kamikaze mission of Coca-Cola to destroy a new product by Pepsi. So let's dive in.
Cheryl, do you remember Crystal Pepsi?
Sort of. I don't think it was around very long.
That's right. Crystal Pepsi was introduced to shake up the soda market, and Pepsi poured $40 million into marketing it.
And that's before inflation.
Indeed. It was launched during the Super Bowl and introduced as a New Age cola.
And it did reasonably well.
Initially, it was on the market in the spring of 1992 and off the market by the end of 1994.
A short lifespan for a product so heavily invested in.
Because about a half year after Crystal Pepsi launched, Coke introduced Tab Clear.
But it wasn't quite for competition. It was more sinister than that.
Coke didn't want to tarnish their name, so they went with Tab Clear, a product with one purpose, to make clear colas confusing and end their run.
And it worked. But how?
Well, the full story comes from an interview in marketing writer Stephen Denny's 2011 book, Killing Giants, 10 Strategies to Topple the Goliath in Your Industry. And in the book, he speaks with Sergio Zimon, who just happened to be the Coca-Cola chief marketing officer during the launch of Tab Clear. Using the Tab name rather than Coke mattered. Tab was already their least popular soda brand, and while Crystal Pepsi came in regular and diet flavors, Tab Clear was only an artificially sweetened diet drink.
And diet sodas weren't nearly as popular in the early 90s as they are today. So some people assumed Crystal Pepsi was a diet drink because of Tab Clear.
On top of that, according to what's left of the record of this marketing campaign, if you can call it that, Tab Clear was specifically marketed to women. I've seen it described as the Virginia Slims of sodas.
So Coke was trying to actively turn men away from their product by making it appear to be a soda for ladies. And Crystal Pepsi as well, by association. And frankly, I think that's just weird.
Hey, the 90s were a weird time.
The 90s were awesome.
Fine, I'll give you that one. But the most important ingredient in this plan was the ingredients. Coke called Tab Clear full-flavored, but reviews described it as peppery, cinnamony, medicinal, and just not like Tab.
So you're saying it wasn't very good?
I'm saying I don't think drinking a peppery cola sounds particularly appealing.
I don't either. And I don't honestly think I ever tried it.
And lots of people associated Tab Clear with Crystal Pepsi, and the rest is history.
So mission accomplished?
Tab Clear itself only lasted into the spring of 1993, a product failure that didn't harm the Coca-Cola brand but did take down a promising competitor's product along the way.
Clever marketing, albeit a little sneaky. I think Don Draper would approve.
We can't really know how much Tab Clear contributed to the fall of Crystal Pepsi, but both left the market within months of each other. In fact, even during what might have been considered Crystal Pepsi's heyday, it was being poked fun at constantly, including during a Saturday Night Live skit where they introduced the world to Crystal Gravy.
Crystal Gravy. You've never seen a gravy like this.
But it came back in the past few years briefly as a throwback from Pepsi. I didn't try it then, but if I see it on shelves now, I'm definitely going to pick one up. And not the diet version either.
Like I said, the 90s are cool again. Classic Nintendo's back.
I know this 90s teen has one.
Well, let's leave that there. You've been listening to Serving Up Science, this series all about food, where it comes from, and how it impacts our health and our planet. I'm Karel Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum, and this is WKAR.
Thanks, Cheryl and Karel. And you can hear our Serving Up Science team every Wednesday afternoon at 4:44 and 6:44 on 90.5 WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Summer will be over before we know it, and the Lansing Symphony Orchestra has a season of goodies starting in the fall. Maestro Timothy Muffet sat down with Jamie Paisley to talk about them.
Each of the five Masterwork series, they all have a soloist. Sometimes, you know, you just do concert pieces, but you're starting with a homegrown talent.
Right. Well, this is one of our unspoken initiatives that I've spoken about so much, I don't think I can refer it to as unspoken anymore. We do like to feature our local talent that's gone out and done great things. And there are just so many people that got their start here in the mid-Michigan area and have gone out to make an extraordinary impact in the world of music. And that's the case of Melissa White. She has is one of the founding members of the Harlem String Quartet. And she's coming back to open our season with two wonderful pieces, the Chanson Poème and the Havanaise of Saint-Saëns.
For the second concert, it is another performer who, for the instrument that she plays, there's not a lot of repertoire.
Right.
But there is something new that has been written for her.
Correct. So Ava Ordman, who is an extraordinary performer on the trombone, had been working with David Biedenbender, who is on the faculty at Michigan State University. We are going to be giving the world premiere of a piece that he gave the colorful name, Their Eyes Are Fireflies.
When you have a piece that is written from somebody local like David Biedenbender, does he have free rein and then you look at the instrumentation and program around what will work with that?
Yeah, good question. We talked about that early on. So as I was planning this season, I approached him and said, what are you anticipating this orchestra, the instrumentation? And then we planned that concert around that instrumentation.
Which in this case is the Brahms Third Symphony, Beethoven's Egmont Overture. For the third Lansing Symphony concert, Semiramide by Rossini is a very famous female warrior hero figure, and then followed up by a Pulitzer Prize winning composer that is a woman as well.
Right, and a woman soloist as well. All of whom kind of fit into that Semiramide mold. I mean, extraordinary women with a very powerful presence.
And this is the Jennifer Higdon is the composer we're talking about. The Harp Concerto, this is a new piece. It's a co-commission?
Brand new. We're part of a consortium. We're presenting the premiere in this region. And we are part of a collection of several orchestras that went together to help make this happen.
In the fourth Masterworks concert, Rainbow Body is easily Christopher Theofanidis's best-known work, but you've gone somewhere else with that.
Rainbow Body, we did a few seasons ago, and it was so well-received by our audience, I thought that they would enjoy hearing another work of his. And this is a work, Visions and Miracles, and the title is quite evocative of how the music sounds. Yeah. It's very spiritual music.
And for the grand finale of the Lansing Symphony season, you're bringing back somebody that was just here a couple of seasons ago.
Yes, Daniel Hsu came to us as part of our partnership with the Gilmore competition. And some great things have been happening for Daniel. He's been a medalist in the Clyburn competition. So we thought the audience would like to see kind of where he is now and where he's gotten to since he was here before.
While Maestro Timothy Muffet and I only had time to discuss the upcoming Lansing Symphony Masterworks concerts, there are also the Pops Chamber and Family Series performances as well. More information about the whole season is available online at lansingsymphony.org. In East Lansing, Jamie Paisley, WKAR News.
And with that, we'll say goodbye. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. For the entire WKAR News team, thank you for listening to Current State. We will connect with you again next week.
We spent the late nights making things right between us. But now it's all good, babe. Roll that backwood, babe, and let me close. 'Cause girls like you run around with guys like me till sundown. When I come through, I need a girl like you, yeah, yeah. Girls like you love fun and yeah, me too.